Bertolino.
Thank you and welcome to everyone. I hope to share some of the excitement that's been happening at our company in recent months. I'm sure you'll appreciate it. If you miss anything in the presentation, it's available on our website, so you can visit it as much as you like. Usually I tell people they have to memorize this, but this late in the day, I'll give you a pass as long as you see that it's safe harbor and forward-looking statements. Okay, Innovation Pharmaceuticals has a value proposition, and not only do we have innovative science at the company, but it's an exceptionally strong clinical pipeline. And I think the real prize at the end of the day is that we're addressing multi-billion dollar markets, and for a little company, that's quite an aspiration. But I think after you hear the presentation, you'll see where we are today, and hopefully we have our sights appropriately targeted. One of the major things that's happened this past year has been work on novel mechanisms of action, as exemplified with our psilocybin franchise, and I'll be telling you a little bit about that. Most of our candidates are solidly in mid-phase two or later, and as I mentioned, there are multiple therapeutic areas that we are able to address with our pipeline. Here's the bottom line. We have three great drug candidates. We start with psilocybin, which was a compound originally fully synthetically put together to be an anti-infective agent. And this was really beautiful science, where the drug was designed to have a positive charge on one face and a hydrophobic charge on the other side, so it fits into bacterial membranes, and it turns out to be quite effective as an antibacterial agent. But the really exciting thing, not only does it do that, but it's anti-inflammatory on the basis of phosphodiesterase 4 inhibition. So you'll see some indications, which fortunately have been quite successful for us this past year, where that's been put to good use. Kevitran is a small molecule aimed at modulating P53, which is a prevalent issue in over half of all types of cancer. And in particular, in ovarian cancer, over 95% of people have mutant P53. So we've been doing some work in that regard with our Kevitran project. And finally, our Pyrosol program is an orally delivered agent for treatment of psoriasis. We just completed our phase 2B trial on that, and we're sorting and dicing our data, and hopefully we'll have our results from the study this quarter, this year. So that's the scope of our compounds. We have three exciting drug candidates. And what we've been able to accomplish this past year, I think, has been very satisfying for us. In the psilocybin franchise, we were able to get a positive phase 2 trial in oral mucositis. And this is not only looking at trying to ease the symptoms, it's aimed at preventing oral mucositis, which is a tremendously difficult problem in terms of cancer treatment, for which there's no really good effective treatment. So when I show you our results, hopefully you'll have the same optimism that we have. In addition, we had a positive phase 2A trial on very distal colitis, ulcerative colitis. That's one of the types of inflammatory bowel disease. Our Kevitran study also started to give us some positive results in looking at the first couple of patients. And this trial was really just designed to show in patients' tumors rather than at the laboratory bench that we really modulate P53 and associated pathways. And I'll show you a baby picture of one of our Western blot gels, which is really exciting, that shows that. Pyrosol, as I mentioned, I wish all science would go that quickly. But at this point, with psoriasis, we completed the phase 2B trial. We're going to have that data come out this quarter. Okay. Multi-billion dollar market opportunities. This one is just depicting where we can go with our psilocybin franchise, starting with oral mucositis, inflammatory bowel disease, and skin and skin structure infections. That's for our candidate number one. Candidate number two, Kevitran, ovarian cancer. Desperate needs for new treatments, and this is not a toxic medication, so we're hopeful that we'll be able to do some real good for people who are able to move that along in the developmental pathway. And Pyrosol and psoriasis, these are all innovative products that will merit higher premiums if they deliver what we hope to be able to do. Now, there are multiple indications for each one, so I think that's best exemplified in where we currently are in our real estate franchise. I told you about the things we're approaching right now, but there are also other indications, as you can see here, that we can pursue in that franchise as well. All very attractive. Same types of things and multiple indications for various cancers and the psoriasis franchise. The major therapeutic areas with brilocidin are depicted here. Looking at oral mucositis, inflammatory bowel disease, and infectious disease. But these are only the major ones we're working on right now. There are more to add to this list. So I think there will be a lot in store for us. And the way I like to refer to this franchise is anchored. And the reason I refer to it as anchored, you'll see in our results from our clinical studies. Ovarian cancer, as I mentioned, also a major therapeutic area, and psoriasis. Here's our approach. We're a tiny little company. We've got a great pipeline. And the question is, how do we make that go forward in the direction we'd like to see it go? We'd like to select our key programs for continued internal development. We'd like to maximize the value of our current assets, and it's definitely time to have some partnerships. This is how we'll be able to move all of the assets forward. So that's our strategy right now. I think it makes a lot of sense, and it's built on the foundation that we have good results. Now let me show you some of those good results. Here is our oral mucositis trial. And you know, this is a devastating problem. People get terrible problems with bad ulcerations that are not just uncomfortable. They can require hospitalization, feeding tubes, really serious consequences of getting chemo radiation for various cancers. And in this population, we looked at head and neck cancer. And in that population, everybody's going to get oral mucositis. It's the severe oral mucositis that causes the really bad problems. And that happens historically in the range of about 60 to 70%. And you can see what happened here. We treated people three times a day with an oral rinse and spit, a very simple kind of formulation, to see if we could help them in terms of preventing, not just ameliorating problems associated with this, but preventing it. And we were very fortunate to see these results and to see depicted on this slide. Here is what we saw in our study, placebo group, severe oral mucositis characterized by WHO grade 3 or greater, happening in 60%, and typically it's 60 or 70% of the population, so that's consistent with historic norms. When we looked at our modified intent to treat population, that was reduced from the 60% down to 42.9%. It's hard for people in these populations to really stick very carefully to prescribed regimens on what they're doing. Not everybody is able to do that. But when they are, they're in the per-protocol population. And so if they followed the instructions properly, didn't take the wrong medicines, miss doses, things like that, they ended up getting the benefit of having a reduced incidence of a grade 3 or greater oral mucositis at 36.8%. So this is actually a pretty nice spread. Another way you can look at this is what happens to the people who would get severe oral mucositis. What's the relative risk reduction? That's another way of looking at these numbers. So if you look at that 60% of people who end up getting a severe oral mucositis, how much can you reduce that in that group of 60%? And that's what's shown here on the right side of the slide. And in the per-protocol population, it's close to 40%. And in the modified intent-to-treat population, it's close to 30%. So that's actually a good value proposition for the patients who really don't have much else to do in terms of trying to protect themselves from this. Now, one really great way to look at results that's usually reserved for cancer studies, but is good for a lot of other ways to analyze data, is a Kaplan-Meier curve. And you look at what happens as a function of time. And this sort of tells you the story in a very clear kind of presentation. What you have here on the y-axis is people who get the severe oral mucositis, the percentage of people who get that. And this is time in terms of days. So if you look out here, as time goes on, at about 3 weeks is when people start to get severe oral mucositis. And you can follow this curve up, more and more people in the placebo group get it, up to about that 60% level here over over that period of time. And this is devastating for them. This is really not good. Look what happens when you're taking the psilocybin. Well, you get a few people who start not in such a different time frame, but really right away, you get this grace period in here from between 28 to about 42 days when nothing happens in those people. They don't get the oral mucositis that they would otherwise have gotten if they were in the placebo group. You then get a few more stragglers towards the end, and it goes up to the reduced level where you get the benefit of reaching about the 40% level relative to the 60% that people would normally have. So this is a very informative Kaplan-Meier curve. The benefit, if you wanted to figure out where's the overall benefit here, it's the area between the curves. But you can see in very clear depiction that this is a great period here, and that eventually you don't even get the same amount of severe oral mucositis. So I believe this is really anchored now, showing that we're doing some good for people who get severe oral mucositis from head and neck cancer and preventing it. Okay, psilocybin for inflammatory bowel disease. We weren't really sure what this was going to do, so we took the simplest approach, which I always think is the best. We looked at distal colitis. We looked at something called ulcerative proctitis, which is at the tail end in the rectal area. And we made a rectal enema, nothing fancy, just our drug in some water as a retention enema. And we gave it to people nightly for 42 days. And this is what we got as results. Now, a lot of times when people look, they say, oh, what are the clinical endpoints and all the rest of that? I think you have to hold this all to a higher bar. What we did was we just did an open-label study looking at three dose levels, 50, 100, 200 milligrams of the retention enema. And in all of these groups, you can see that we met clinical remission in over half of the people. Well, what's the bar that's set? That's not just asking, how do you feel? This is the criteria for clinical remission. Not only does it require zero rectal bleeding, and these people bleed a lot, it requires at least stable or improved stool frequency, but the real thing it required is an endoscopic evaluation. So we have endoscopic videos showing what their gut looks like before treatment and after treatment. And here what you see on this screen is just some still pictures. It's not nearly as good as the movies. The movies are wonderful. And you can see what's really happening as a function of where people are looking with the endoscopy. But what you see here is you can see areas of ulceration in the before area in the rectum in two different patients that clears up quite nicely in the pictures on the bottom. You see good blood vasculature. You see what looks like healthy GI mucosa. So this was very exciting for us because in both of these cases, we administered the drug locally. And if you think both of these cases have a messed up epithelium, you'd be right, they have ulcerations. Is this drug going to be absorbed? Are you going to get tremendous systemic levels of the drug? Well, turns out the answer is no. And so that means we can get the local benefit without getting any burden of systemic side effects because so little of it actually is absorbed. That also has implications for other things. I mentioned where we are right now in these programs, but if you think about other disorders, something like atopic dermatitis, what a wonderful indication this would be for using this drug. You have the anti-inflammatory component conferred by the inhibition of phosphodiesterase 4. But everybody knows that these people who have atopic dermatitis, their condition's much worse when they have a bad bacterial population on their skin. And sometimes they'll get better even with antibiotics just by reducing that microbiome burden that they have. So I think there are other indications which, by virtue of knowing that we can deliver drug locally with good clinical benefit, that we should be able to pursue as well. So I believe at this point, with the anti-inflammatory components, we have a lot to look forward to. We haven't forgotten that we had an effective phase 2b study where we compared a single dose IV of psilocybin versus a standard dose of 7 days treatment with vancomycin. Vancomycin yielded a 93.8% clinical response, and the single IV dose of psilocybin gave 92.2%. So this is basically non-inferior. It's got a great future as an antibacterial, and that's the second punch of the 1-2 punch if we get to treat atopic dermatitis as well. Here are the baby pictures I told you about. So you know how hard it is to get any kind of results that really look good? When you try and do bench work, and you do Western blots, you get all excited when you get positive results. This was designed looking at patients' actual tumors. Because p53 is involved in over half of cancers, you can look in a bunch of different places. But I mentioned ovarian cancer has a mutation rate of p53 in excess of 95%. So what we did was we gave these folks our drug as much as we possibly could. It's got a short half-life. It's only about 2 hours or so. And it takes 180 minutes to infuse this drug. So we gave it to them 3 times a week for 3 weeks. And that's asking a lot for somebody to devote that time for that. And this was to see if we could modulate p53, which is our goal in this particular study. Preclinically, we have a beautiful package of data showing modulation of p53 and associated pathways in cell lines and in hosted tumors in mice. But you really want to see this in people. So to get anything to work in people is always a roll of the dice. But we decided we would go ahead with this. And we're looking not only at Western blots, but we're doing RNA-seq analyses to look at gene expression levels. And it's really some high-tech science. But the simplicity is really depicted in the Western blots here, which tell you what's happening with the protein levels that are being measured. So these are tumors from patients who have ovarian cancer, the recalcitrant, refractory to cisplatin, etc. And what you can see on the left-hand panel here is Christmas colors, basically. The red colors are the reference proteins which let you know specifically for actin that you have a uniform population of cells. That's what actin measures. And we also have a tumor-specific marker that's only in tumors. And if you look from left to right here, you'll see all of those red bars are basically the same. When you look above it where you see p53, and look at what happens on day zero, I didn't mean for you to have to look that quickly, but if you look at what happens here on day zero, there's a faint green bar. And it's very obvious that on day 21, the faint green bar got to be a lot more intense. That means more of the p53 protein is being expressed on a background that's stable, as shown by actin levels and claudin-4 levels. So p53 doesn't just sit there as p53. When it becomes activated, it gets phosphorylated. So another good thing to look at would be phospho-p53 and see if it does the same kind of thing. So if you draw your attention to the right-hand side of the screen, it's the same kind of setup, again with a cell line for reference, and stable actin levels and stable claudin-4 levels, and look at day 0 and look at day 21. It's absolutely clear that there's more signal on day 21. So this is the first evidence we've been able to show in actual patient tumors that we're modulating p53. We're doing all kinds of fancy analyses on gene expression, and we're looking at what pathways are getting modulated, and we're going to get a lot more information out of that. But these are the baby pictures that are exciting to us because it's the first data that we've gotten out of the game. Our psoriasis study that I told you we recently had last patient, last visit for, this is our phase 2 study. This was looking at mild to moderate psoriasis. So we weren't sure what it was going to do, if anything. And we looked at an endpoint just of investigative global assessment because that's a 30,000-foot view. And you want to know, do you get a signal or not? Well, what you see in these bars here, in these lines, is a cluster of lines down here that includes placebo and the two low-dose groups. And then you see the higher-dose group up here standing apart in terms of the percentages of subjects who had a greater than or equal to 2-point improvement in the investigative global assessment. So that means at this dosage level, we saw something. And it was enough to convince us that this should be the basis of doing the phase 2b study that we just completed. Now, I mentioned this is in mild to moderate psoriasis. The registration population is moderate to severe psoriasis. So how do you make that transition? Well, it turns out two-thirds of these people in this phase 2a study, two-thirds of them had moderate psoriasis. So actually, the bridge from mild to moderate psoriasis with the phase 2a study into the moderate to severe group in the phase 2b study is substantiated by the data here. And if we slice and dice the data, it turns out instead of the 35% improvement, 35% of subjects showing that change, it's about 46% when you look at the moderate population. So that makes you think, well, it's going to work even better when you look at the registration population. Okay, so here's the study. We did basically what we did previously. However, it's moderate to severe, which is the registration population. We looked at 200 milligrams as our top dosing group in the phase 2A. And the interesting thing about this particular drug, for which we have a composition of matter patent, is it is an ester of an existing drug that does nothing for psoriasis. It's an ester of abacavir, an antiviral agent originally brought to market by Glaxo. And by virtue of making this glycolic acid ester, it confers the benefit for psoriasis. We've seen some results in preclinical models. We've seen some modulation of something called PRINS, which is a non-translated RNA that's elevated in psoriatic inflamed tissue. And we've also seen modulation of IL-20. Whether that's actually the mechanism of action here or just part of the story, we don't know yet at this point. But we have it on good response from FDA that if we met the criteria that we showed, that we're not exceeding the dose of abacavir, the major metabolite of this, and we can show that our ester is metabolized to the abacavir, that we could do the equivalent of a 505B2, where you end up using that as a reference drug, and then that abbreviates your phase 3 program. So it makes it a lot easier to come across the finish line. So that also encouraged us to do the phase 2B study. And then in this study, we looked at slightly higher doses, the main group, 300 milligrams of Purisol per day in a divided dose, and the higher group, 400, versus placebo. And again, remember what I told you, abacavir would be the reference drug. The standard dose for that is 600 milligrams. So we're well within that safety range. We enrolled 3:3:1, 300 placebo versus 400. 199 patients were randomized, 12 weeks of treatment, 34 sites in the U.S. And the design is very similar to what we did in the phase 2A study. So we're anxious to see what those results are. At least we're done. It's tough to recruit to these trials these days because you see too many psoriasis commercials at night on TV. So it's a lot more difficult than it used to be. This is our group of talented people at the company. You can look at that at your leisure on our website. Very important to know that we have wholly owned global commercialization rights for each of our compounds. So the intellectual property portfolio is very robust at this point, so we can protect what we have. And that brings us to where we are. So over the last year, year and a half or so, what we've done is we've brought our drug candidates to a point, I believe, of value inflection. In the psilocybin franchise, I believe we're anchored. We showed that this works in our early studies for inflammatory bowel disease, the most distal form being the ulcerative proctitis that we looked at. The devastating problem of oral mucositis looks really encouraging. And honestly, there's really nothing out there other than palliative treatments right now. So I think this paves a potentially very exciting path for us to go forward. And don't forget that we were non-inferior to daptomycin for skin and skin structure. So I think that really sort of anchors the psilocybin franchise for us. We're excited about what we see happening with Kevitrin, and we're anxiously awaiting the results of Purisol. So this year, we've been talking with a lot of people, not only at this meeting, but at other get-togethers, and we're trying to leverage all of this. We're trying to get partnering opportunities come to reality. We're trying to make sure that our drugs are properly formulated for best delivery. And again, we're trying to address unmet medical need for the benefit not only of patients, but our shareholders. This is very important as well. And we're anchoring each of our drug candidates in what we think will be a very good favorable return on investment. And with the 14 seconds I have left, we'll close. Thank you.
Thank you very much.